site owner.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
2:15.
2:15.
Okay. We're going to open today's committee meeting on the education interim education committee. We have some guests in the room who are going to be part of our presentations today. But today is the 25th.
Fourth.
I got a day ahead. Thank you. 24th. And it's
darn, I wish it was
2:00.
We can go home.
So again, welcome to the Interim Committee on Education. And what we're going to do, we're going to have some informational presentations on REAP, Student Leadership Day, Student Success, Every Student Succeeds Act, the School Facilities Expenditures, Workforce Needs in Southern Oregon, A New Path to Assessment, and Poverty Funding Update, because there's different things that have happened in education that people would like to have answers to. So we're going to start out with an informational meeting on REAP, Student Leadership Day. Is Mark Jackson and the rest of the people, come on up. Whoever you want to bring up here to the microphone, you invite them up.
Yeah.
And thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us. I'm Nate Golden, Director of Programs for REAP, Inc., and I'm coming in on behalf of Mark Jackson and the REAP organization. And I would like to thank you for giving us this opportunity to bring our students to come and give public comment before you guys and testify about the issues that they face as young people, as well as share about their experience in REAP. So with that, I'm going to have the students come up and share. Thank you.
Thank you. He knows the secret of getting them apart, so you just wait, he'll come get them for you. So who is going to start first?
My name is Isabel Munguia.
You can pull it a little bit to you if you want, but not too far. That's perfect.
My name is Isabel Munguia. I am a sixth grader from Ron Russell Middle School, and I am a REAP ambassador.
My name is Alexandria Griffey. I'm 12. I'm in sixth grade. I'm from Ron Russell Middle School, and I am a REAP ambassador.
Hello, my name is Jessica Monje Perez. I'm 17. I'm a junior at David Douglas High School, and I'm a REAP ambassador.
You don't have to get too close. You're okay. He'll pick you
Hello,
up.
Hello, my name is Jantasia Unique Davis. I go to Ron Russell Middle School. I'm 12 years old, and I am a REAP ambassador.
Hello, I'm just going to discuss a little bit about the system.
Say your name over one more time as you get ready to speak.
Okay.
So thank you.
Again, I'm Jessica Mohan Perez, and I'd like to have some suggestions of improvements in our school system. I'd like to start out with allowing you to participate in decisions being made that eventually impact us. We have the capacity to make choices, and like my principal said, the best choices he made included youth voice. I also understand why we have state testing, but it has been discussed a lot how everybody has a different learning pace, and it takes up a lot of class time, and most of the time it's in the middle of a semester, so we haven't even finished learning everything that's on the test. And then the teacher-to-student ratio, I think, is really important because it's really difficult for the teachers to meet the needs of all the students when they have 40 students to one English teacher. And then having cultural awareness is very important, especially in a very diverse school. And Portland is very diverse, and therefore I feel like having cultural ethnic studies can definitely do really good for everybody. And then the schools are being very advanced in technology. And coming from a very poor neighborhood, it's hard to do all your homework online when you don't have internet access. So just providing those spaces for the community to have those access so they can succeed in school. And the system of discipline at our schools, if you're late to class, you get taken out 30 minutes early from your class to go to lunch detention. It's really contradicting the point of even having the discipline, so maybe just brainstorming different ways of disciplining the students without taking away their education. And then, providing transit passes for youth really opens up the doors to different opportunities. Once you hit high school, many students start going to jobs, and then they need resources and internships and all volunteering work, and it's really difficult when we don't all have the money to afford a car or the money to buy a transit pass, and just having that just really helps in so many different ways. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Isabel McGee again, and REAP is having a large impact on me because it's teaching me even more to work with others and persevere, and it's teaching me that I can do more than I ever thought I ever could do.
Thank you.
Okay, my name is Alexandria Griffey, and REAP has impacted my life by teaching me how to help other people and raising money for people who need it.
My name is Jantasia Davis, and how REAP, how it impacted me is it had opened my eyes to a new world, and not just as a REAP student and a leadership student, it has opened my eyes as a Ron Russell student.
We thank you for having us here, and we really appreciate if you guys can continue funding the REAP program. It's such a great program. It's really increased the attendance rates, especially for people of color who attend this after school. It opens up our opportunities to meet different people and know what career we want to go to, and just making those connections between the students and all the careers out there and the people that we wouldn't be able to access by ourselves. And it's still going on because it's a great program, and we really appreciate if you guys can keep funding it.
My name is Isma Mungia. One of the many things that the program REAP has done in this school year was we made a video for the fifth graders to show that middle school isn't as scary as they think it is. Because a lot of fifth graders have concerns, think that it's going to be a really big change for them. But when we made the video to show that, you know, you can still have fun, but, you know, you still have your school life, you know?
Okay. Another one of the many reasons we have done REAP is held a fundraiser at one of our many track meets for Boxes of Love. Boxes of Love is basically people making boxes with clothes and toys for kids who need it and have nothing in their foster homes.
My name is Jantasia Davis, and I want to talk about two things. One thing is, I believe that even though at school we learn multiple things, it will help students learn if we don't learn something and move on to the next, if we take our time to understand. Another thing that I think that is really important is to learn how to do state testing, like have more practice in order to get a good grade.
I think we're done here, and we really thank you for your time.
So before you go, in the committee here, one of the things, after you give your presentation, we always open it up to all of our members if they have any questions of you. So are there any questions for her? Yes, Senator Bearsugar.
I'm starting from the left and go to the right. Tell me what you want to do when you grow up.
I have had multiple things that I would like to do, but I kind of think, like, today, I kind of want to do what you guys do, because I think education is kind of, like, a power, and it's very, like, inspiring to me, and I think people should know and have a chance to learn about education.
My name is Jessica, and I've really been leaning into the policies just because I've seen a lot of inequities in my community, and I think the best way to approach them is representing all the people that are underrepresented and just bringing all the issues to the table.
I think that I would like to either be a teacher, because I like to help students in their education, and if that doesn't really go well for me, I would probably like to take over my dad's business, landscaping.
Very nice.
I would really like to be a doctor to help those who need the help if they're hurt.
Okay.
Great.
Any other questions from anyone? Thank you very much for coming here. Thanks for sharing your insights. I appreciate the thoughtfulness that you put into that, whether it's the state testing and how to make it better, or the discipline in your schools, or just the idea that at least one principal you talked to said that some of the best decisions I made were ones that included students as part of that decision-making process. And I think that it's important to hear the people who are in the schools and hear their concerns. And I have found, as also as a principal, that people think that children won't have great ideas. But the reality is they sit in those classes for 6 or 7 hours a day, and they have a lot of time to think. And oftentimes what they think would make it a lot better for all of us in that environment. So hopefully from your testimony here and maybe other people hearing it, people will have the idea that maybe we should talk to the people who we're trying to educate to see how best to go about doing that. So thanks for taking your time out of your schedule to come here and inform us.
Thank you for your time.
I have one question.
So thanks. Please.
Yes.
And if you give me a number to text, I'll text a picture from up here looking at them. So you just send me give me a number.
I got you. Great. And then did you get the list of names?
I will.
Okay. All right. Hello, everyone. My name is Jordan Coleman, and I am a REAP employee. And currently, I am the project coordinator for an equity project that I'm leading, and I work with community stakeholders, including district officials for the David Douglas School District. I work with principal, vice principal, parents, and even our students. So these are my kids from Ron Russell Middle School and David Douglas High School. And I pretty much just wanted to share with you guys the process that I've been doing for this grant. It is funded by the Oregon Youth. Got to pull up my notes. It's funded by the Oregon Youth Development Commission. And through a series of 8 months, I've worked with these community stakeholders to organize and put together a survey that the students took. So we have all 3,200 students at David Douglas completed a survey that will address school climate. And right now we have the data, which we hope to analyze and in hopes that we can get a better understanding of what the school is lacking and how we can better improve and implement an equity lens and address the poverty rates that are happening at David Douglas. So it is our intent to use this assessment tool, the survey, to advance student voice and achieve a more cultural responsive and equitable school climate. With this said, I hope that you guys have a better understanding of this equity project that I'm leading, and to please consider the following. Visit our programs at one of our school sites. So right now we have Ron Russell Middle School here and David Douglas High School. And then to also support REAP's application for the HB, the House Bill 2016 funding. We did recently apply for that grant. And then sponsor a legislative bill to allocate funding to support REAP programming focused on entrepreneurship, civil engagement, leadership, and restorative justice programming to increase college and career readiness for culturally diverse and low-income students.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions? I will tell the students that we asked before the group started, you asked a question about what are the things that we do. One of the things is House Bill 2016.
Mm-hmm.
It's called House Bill because it originated over in the House, came to the Senate, we had to pass it too, and then had to go to the governor to get signed to become the law. And the resources that go into it are also come from this bill. And the commission from which she said she got her money has to come back to these committees and give us a report of what they have been doing with mm-hmm. those money. So mm-hmm. hopefully we'll hear about your program in a report at some down the road. So it all gets connected when it comes back here. So that's why it's important for you to come and get to know a little bit better, more about how this thing works, how we work here. So
awesome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
Thank you.
And I don't know if you're going to spend time and stay around and listen to the rest of it, but you're certainly welcome. You also have a chance you can tour the building and whatever as well. So see the rest of this building. And if you get up in the Senate wings and up on the top floor, you can find our office. So I'll be there to help you, too.
Thank you.
One question, yes. Come on up to the, you have to come up to the microphone, even if you ask a question, now that we're in session. And you have to say your name one more time.
My name is Alexandria Griffey, and earlier you had said that you were a principal.
I was.
What school were you a principal
at? Marshfield High School in Coos Bay, Oregon. So it's on the Oregon coast. And you have a superintendent in your district, David Douglas. And his, do you know your superintendent's name?
No.
Don. That help? I think it's Don Grotting. I think that's David Douglas. And he started out in a school district right next to mine. And he's a good friend. And he's a person who I tried to steal away from Powers, Oregon, and come work at my high school. But he went to David Douglas. What can I say? He's a great person. So.
Okay.
You can say hi to him from Senator Roblin. We know each other for a long time. So, again, thank you very much. And thanks, all of you, for being here.
Thank
you. So we're going to close our informational meeting on REAP, REAP Student Leadership Day. And we're going to open an informal meeting on Every Student Succeeds Act. And with that, Salam Noor, our department chair. And while Salam's coming, you guys can get up and head out if you want.
Thank you.
But I know he was excited to have you here, too.
Good job.
Thank you. So welcome and thank you for being here. We are excited to hear all the wonderful things, and we would hope it's a short synopsis because I looked at the bill and it's a little large, so you don't need to go through it word for word for us.
So, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Jan McComb, the legislative director for the Oregon Department of Education, and I'm here with Deputy Superintendent Salam Noor, who's going to talk about the new federal ESSA, Every Student Succeeds Act law. And if you look on your committee meeting page, we have sent in several informational pieces, a summary of the law, and also an update on each of the four work groups that have been meeting and talking about where we go from here. And Dr. Noor will talk about that now. And I'll be your tech support over here.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. For the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I'm really pleased to be able to be with you today and to share some information relative to the department's work on the Every Student Succeeds Act. As the initial slide indicated, we're using this as an opportunity to reimagine education in the state of Oregon. We do intend to submit a plan to the U.S. Department of Education, but the conversations have been much broader than that, and they've been about education in Oregon and how we use that information to inform the plan, but use it in our work as a department, use it with the State Board of Education, and also hopefully provide information to you that you can use in policy making and legislative actions. So just by a quick way of background, what is the Every Student Succeeds Act? You are aware that it is essentially the reauthorization of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. It's the largest federal law in the United States that informs K-12 education. It was established in 1965, and essentially it's a civil rights law. It is founded on equity and equitable outcomes for all students. It replaces the No Child Left Behind law. And what's exciting and what we have welcomed immensely relative to this law is the flexibility that's been afforded to us in key areas that I will discuss with you here shortly. It does maintain safeguards relative to accountability and responsibility on the part of the states that translate to accountability and responsibility on the part of school districts in our state. So what does it mean for Oregon? The law is very comprehensive. However, it does afford us flexibility in key areas that I think most educators care the most about, if you will, because they have an impact on their daily activities and functions. And those areas are assessment, accountability, school improvement, and educator effectiveness. And again, I want to keep emphasizing the way we've approached this is much broader than just focusing on the law itself. It's really broader conversations with communities throughout the state to help inform our plan. And those conversations really have been about a seamless education system from cradle to career. It's about ensuring students have access to well-rounded education and improving outcomes for all students, and specifically graduation. The timeline that we're under is fairly aggressive. The law was actually passed in December of 2015, and since then we've had both internal and external efforts to interpret the law, understand what the law is asking us to do, and have moved forward with a process that involves both stakeholder engagement in both formal and informal conversations, structured and non-structured interactions with educators and Oregonians in general. That's happening between April and June. And in the summer, we intend to gather all of that information, analyze it, synthesize it, and begin to draft a plan that we will have available by the end of August to share with communities throughout the state, practitioners, and partners. The goal is to have a plan ready to go between September and December, with additional opportunities for input and feedback. And once we receive final guidance from the U.S. Department of Education, which we're anticipating to be in October of 2016, we can submit. But it's something that has required an enormous amount of work and time and effort on our part as an agency, but of many partners around the state. So how are we engaging stakeholders? We have, as I mentioned earlier, structured and non-structured opportunities. The structured opportunities involve four work groups in the four areas that I mentioned earlier: the standards and assessment, the accountability, school improvement, and educator effectiveness. Those groups are comprised of educators from around the state. We have representatives from community-based organizations, communities of color, diverse members from really across all of those different categories that we typically work with. We have teachers, principals, superintendents, we have business representation, we have board members, we have a variety of stakeholders that are involved in this work. I'll share with you an anecdote. When we started to develop those work groups, we requested applications from interested stakeholders, and within a two-week time frame, we received 300 applications. So the interest is great, and we're delighted to have so many participants involved in the process. And these work groups really operate as thought partners. They share ideas, perspectives through a collaborative approach. They help us develop key recommendations and considerations, and they will help us with the draft of that section of the plan. The community forums have been really exciting. We've organized 13 community forums. We've completed 9 of those. They are regionally located, and they are set up to directly engage Oregonians about their visions, values, and priorities for education. And the feedback that we've collected will inform the work of the work groups and will inform the work of the agency and hopefully the state as a whole. So I've been to places like Ontario, Redmond, Medford, Eugene, Pendleton. We've had 2 in Portland. We've had 1 in Salem. I go to Hood River on Thursday, and we have 2 additional ones on the coast, South Coast and North Coast, and we have 1 for Sherwood. So we're trying to reach as many communities as we possibly can, and I'll share with you some highlights from those community forums. The advisory committee is really more of an oversight external advisory committee comprised of also practitioners, meaning teachers, counselors, principals, assistant principals, superintendents. We have board members on the committee. We have OSBA, COSA, OEA, and many other partners that are involved in this process, such as STAND, Chalkboard, and others, and the PTA, of course, that are helping us review the recommendations that will come forward from the work groups and engage in a process where we can reach consensus that this is the right direction to go, these are the right policies to adopt, and if needed, to delve deeper into some questions and issues that may arise. And we have lots of existing groups. I have a teacher advisory council that I convene quarterly. We've engaged them relative to this process. We have lots of communities around the state that we're engaging to solicit input and their direct feedback into what we're doing. And we have an online website. We have a website where you can actually communicate with us online, but we're posting all information on this website relative to the work of the work groups, materials that we're developing, anything that pertains to this effort is there. Okay, so I'm going to go really quickly through the 4 work groups because I'm not going to be able to do them any justice by talking about them in such a brief time frame. But the work around standards and assessment, it's really about the standards and the expectations that we have for students. The assessment conversation has really focused on creating a balanced assessment system that operates both at the local level and the state level. The group talked about the use of multiple measures and different types of assessment for learning purposes and not necessarily just for accountability or testing purposes. So the group has had very thoughtful conversations about how do we create that balance between assessment for learning, which is testing that we do for accountability, and different types of testing, if you will, such as formative assessments that teachers do, interim assessments that potentially districts can do, and other types of assessments that we can use to inform the teaching and learning that's happening in the classroom on a daily basis. So these conversations have been really rich. They've been thoughtful and informative, and you'll have an opportunity to hear from our colleagues from OEA today. We will join them in their presentation, path forward. You will see a lot of alignment between the work that this group is doing and the vision that was created in that framework. So these are conversations that are focused on long-term vision, which is a balanced assessment system for the state of Oregon, and short-term areas of need, if you will, such as how do we resource teachers in the implementation of standards? How do we take advantage of the flexibility that's been afforded to us relative to high school assessments? So it's something in addition to SBAC, which could be ACT, SAT, and perhaps others. How do we manage the summative assessment so it doesn't really become the focus, so it's really more of a snapshot about what's happening in that school and not rely almost exclusively on that to inform what we do. The accountability work group is having some great conversations as well relative to how do we define accountability. Currently, accountability is based on students' performance on tests. But we know that schools are comprised of many, many things that are greater and more important than that at times. So we've had conversations relative to how we define accountability. We have academic indicators that we have to include. Assessment and testing could be one of those academic indicators, but there are many other indicators that we can include into our accountability system. So the group is discussing those academic and not non-academic indicators. And especially what I want to emphasize is that accountability will not be based exclusively on a single test score. We're also thinking about how we hold alternative schools accountable, because we use the same model and we know that alternative schools are very different from mainstream high schools. So how do we actually create an accountability system that is fair, that is nimble, that's equitable, without losing sight of the importance of student achievement, because that's what this is all about. School improvement, just very quickly, this is really about building a collaborative process between the state and districts for identifying and supporting schools, and one that would actually involve other stakeholders and potentially the community. And this is building about the experience that we've had here in our state. We've been doing school improvement for a long, long time, and over the past 5 or 6 years, we've had a focused effort relative to focus and priority schools, so we're looking at that. We're learning from our own experience. We want to develop systems that really work for us, that are effective in improving student achievement, but also systems that support the educators that are very heavily engaged in improving schools, improving practices to help support students. So again, these are really good, deep conversations relative to what does school improvement mean? How does a school actually get into school improvement? How do they get out of school improvement? Do we use the same criteria for getting into school improvement to determine if they've made enough progress to get out? Are there other indicators and variables that we should look at? So how do we monitor that? How do we build capacity at the local level within districts, within regions to help support schools? Again, it's really a very positive, constructive conversation relative to how do we support schools that are in need of additional help and additional supports from the state and from their community. The educator effectiveness conversation really starts with Senate Bill 290. Senate Bill 290 established a framework that we're using to develop local evaluation systems, and the conversation really starts from there. We've done something really well in this state. We've implemented Senate Bill 290 for the last 4 or 5 years, I believe, and that was also coupled with the requirements from the U.S. Department of Education in terms of, you know, stipulations that you have to tie student performance to teacher evaluation. So the group is being really thoughtful. They're looking at what we've been implementing for the last several years. They're looking at what has worked, what hasn't worked, and most importantly, they're trying to think about evaluation as a way to build teachers' capacity and school capacity to provide effective educators in every classroom and effective leaders in every school. So again, they're really relying on the experience and the resources we've had in our state for the last few years. Community forums. I am really excited to tell you that these have been quite enlightening in many respects. Our purpose was really to get input from diverse communities, to hear more about Oregonians' priorities and goals for education. Our goal was to listen and learn, and I believe we're accomplishing that through these community forums. And as you look at the chart, you will see that the majority of participants have actually been educators. Principals, superintendents, teachers, instructional assistants, counselors, et cetera. We had a fairly large number of parents participating. We also have representation from higher ed, business community, business representatives, community members, parents, board members, legislators. I'm really excited, though, about the level of participation that we've had from students. We've had students at every single event. The majority of those students were FFA students, and they demonstrated to us their speaking skills, communication skills, collaboration skills. They've been absolutely outstanding, and I would say they've been incredibly insightful. So I agree with you, Senator Roblin, that kids can tell us a lot more than we can imagine. So these have been really great opportunities for us to engage Oregonians, learn about their communities, learn about their needs and how they feel about education and what's important to them. The questions, if you would just do all three questions, Jen. The community forums focused on three key areas, and we didn't really want to, we had limited time, we had 90 minutes for each one of those sessions, and we wanted to take advantage of the time that we had with the participants. So we asked them three questions. We said, what school characteristics are most important to you? And we encouraged them to put on whatever hat they walked through the door with. So they could be a principal, a teacher, a parent, a student, a board member, et cetera. We asked them, how should we measure school success or school quality? And then lastly, we asked them to help us identify how we ensure all students are successful. And that is really the equity question, is how do we ensure that all students are successful no matter where they live, no matter where they go to school, and what goals and aspirations they have. And the dialogue was very rich, and I'm going to share with you a couple of emerging themes. We haven't really inputted, if you will, or uploaded all of the information that we received, but based on the 9 community forums, we have 2 themes that really stand out. And one is about ensuring a rigorous, relevant, well-rounded, engaging educational experiences for all students to a person that was articulated by students, by parents, by educators, legislators, board members, you name it. The second is personalized and individualized learning in order to ensure students acquire the knowledge and skills best suited for their next steps. So rigorous education, well-rounded education, engaging education, and the second is personalized and individualized to meet the need of that individual student. And we have a quote from one of our parents in Malheur County in Pendleton who said, not only do we need to meet students where they are, but we actually have to take them to where they need to go, and that's personalized education, well-rounded education. Under personalized education, I'll just mention a couple of things. Are we missing a slide? Okay. Yeah. So let's go to the first thing. Yeah. So you can see from the slide that this is really about high expectations for all students, having more of an asset-based approach that actually recognizes and appreciates what the student brings to the learning process and what the family actually brings to the learning process. Students and participants in general discuss the culture of caring within the school, within the district, and the community as a whole. Enrichment opportunities were discussed, such as access to music, PE, health, and extracurricular options in school, before school, after school, etc. We heard a lot about attending to the social and emotional needs of students, and that students have the supports that are necessary for them to be successful while in school and as they transition to that next step. Under the personalized learning, we heard a lot about current technical education and how current technical education provides students an opportunity to individualize their own learning, to connect their learning to a career pathway, something that they intend to do after high school and as they pursue further education. We learned about the need for more science, technology, engineering, math, applied learning opportunities that we afford students in our schools. We learned a lot about the need for relationships between students and adults, relationships between students and teachers, relationships between between schools and the community, and it's about taking the school into the community and making that a learning environment, bringing the community into the school. The students in particular articulated the need to have better environments for the educators. They expressed such great empathy for fellow students and the needs of those students, but also this expressed empathy for the teachers and the environment that the teachers were practicing in, and the need for additional supports for them. So it was really intriguing, to say the least, to actually hear the students speak. So lastly, our next steps is that we're going to continue to engage stakeholders. As I mentioned earlier, we will convene our advisory committee to look at the recommendations that are being submitted by the work groups. Then that goes to the State Board of Education and then to the governor. Between July and August, we will continue to solicit additional feedback based on what we're crafting as the draft plan. We'll continue to engage stakeholders. We'll go out and make the information available to the public so they can continue to give us feedback. And once everything is submitted, we will slide into actual implementation. So I'm going to pause here and see if you have any questions or comments.
So are there any questions or comments to this point? Yes, Senator Beyer.
I think this all sounds very nice. But one of the things that concerns me, and what I hear a lot from teachers, is the still on the amount of time and the confusion of how much assessment and testing has to happen. And it would be nice at the end of this process where we get to, if we could just focus down and do whatever you need but not have a proliferation. I think that's important. Mm-hmm. And while I think it's important to look at schools as a totality, I also think we need to have a system that measuring assessment that allows for more immediate feedback to the instructor so that it could be useful to working the mm-hmm. student on mm-hmm. where they may have some deficits in learning, some of that. I don't think the current system does right. that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And a lot of this is really nice. And I've been really supportive and am continuing to be very supportive of career and technical training, but that tends to have when people hear that, I think they think more of what we used to call the old shop classes and things like that. And I think those are important, mm-hmm. but I think we need to keep in mind that the majority of the students are going to want to go forward and get a college education, a full four-year education. So there's a balance of doing both, and I guess that all gets down to something that's not your responsibility. It's more ours, is we have to provide adequate funding so that those services can be delivered, I would say, to today's students as they were to me when I was a student, which I don't think we're doing very well.
Chair Roblin, Senator Beyer, we totally agree with you, and I want to assure you that much of the conversation in the work groups and even internally at the Department of Education has been around making assessment more relevant, making it meaningful, even nimble, if you will, in terms of the information that we provide to students, and hence that the conversation and the accountability work group hasn't really focused on testing being the only way of defining accountability. And the report card could have a lot more information in it that we use to help inform the quality of that school, and testing would be an important but yet small piece of it. So we shift the attention to local assessments, formative assessments, interim assessments that provide teachers immediate information about where that student is relative to their learning. I appreciate your comments, and we totally agree with you. So, thank you.
So I guess what I would comment is that we continue to add more to the bucket that is the teacher's life. So we have the implementation of the requirements for physical education, which from a person who was hyperactive, had I not had opportunities to get out and do that, I would have been a disaster for teachers. I was in early in my life. So at times, I just don't have as many teachers. But there's some real reasons to have these different kinds of things, but helping schools as we go through this, whether they're on a four-day schedule or a five-day schedule, we've got a lot of things that are happening around our state. Helping them with models that allow them to get the hours they need and do it in an organized way would really be helpful for some of those schools, because I know it takes a lot of time and planning to try to figure out how to make a schedule work for a school, an elementary or whatever. I would hope that as we continue to do this, and I've talked to you about this before, that the department is more, that's why I asked for help, instead of stuff coming from them saying things I have to do, but that they offer the assistance that makes it possible to come to that schedule or to find that extra time in the morning to have kids running or doing other activities that can be really helpful for their success as schools, because we know that. Yeah. I mean, the research is out there. It's not just about testing. It's about all the things that are going into that kid's life that allow them to make it. And having visited a school last week, you know, teachers are talking about the kids that come back from the testing crying because they knew they didn't do as well. But they didn't have a chance to practice. The one student said it here. They didn't have a chance to practice on the computer, and then they go into a lab and they have to do it all on computer, and that's not how they learned it. And they just come back total basket cases. And then the teacher has to spend the next day or two getting them back into the mode to be a learner again. And so finding places that are working or things that are happening and getting that information out. I love the fact that you're doing these pilot, these groups around the state, talking to people and getting that information. At the end of the day, how we disseminate that and how we get people to know that they've been listened to and how we get people to understand that there may be other ways to do that that don't put so much stress on the system would really be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. Chair Roblin, we learned a lot from these listening sessions, if you will, or community forums, actually. And we know that there are some really outstanding practices around the state in many areas, not just how we count PE minutes, if you will, or how we provide instruction in a particular environment. And on Friday, I had my teacher advisory committee meeting, and we talked about networks. We talked about how the department can help establish networks for educators to work together and for educators to learn about what they're doing from each other. So that is something that we're focused on right now in terms of providing resources, providing tools, providing supports, providing exemplars of where things are happening really well. And we intend to partner with our schools and districts to continue to do that. We want to support. We want to be helpful. This is a huge cultural shift, in my opinion.
Yep.
It's a cultural shift for schools. It's a cultural shift for educators. It's a cultural shift for state departments of education and agencies. And I've been really encouraged. I mean, there has been times where some participants were really stuck in the NCLB mode. We couldn't get out of that way of thinking. So it's taking some nudging, it's taking some encouragement, but it's also taking some leadership on our part to say we're going to do things differently. Under school improvement, we want to be partners with schools. We don't want to come in and tell schools how to do it. We want to be partners. We want to learn from each other, learn from past experience, learn from research, and together figure it out. So we intend, I appreciate the spirit of the relationship that you're describing, and we intend to move down that path.
And to me, the name says that that's what we're supposed to be doing. Yeah. It's ESSA. It's not No Child Left Behind anymore. It's not together. It's every student succeeding.
And absolutely.
That takes the whole community in, to make it work.
So, absolutely.
Okay. Any other questions for Salon? I appreciate your willingness to do this. And actually, I heard from department you were excited about being able to do that. I appreciate that. I really do, because it says to me that you're engaged in this activity as something that you want to bring meaning to and be a part of. So thank you for that as well.
Thank you. And Senator Knopp attended one of those in Redmond, so you can ask him about it.
Okay. That's good.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Have a great day.
So we're going to close our... Excuse me. I like that sound, by the way, whatever it was. Our informational meeting on the ESSA. And, yep. They're all here. We're going to open an informational meeting on school facilities and expenditures. Come on up, our treasurer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yep, I found that. I'm excited to hear about, this is a big emphasis of all of us about getting money out to schools to do some stuff, and I was surprised to hear the outcome of the original offer, so I'm really happy to hear what's going on now.
Very good. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Wheeler. I'm the treasurer for the state of Oregon. I'm here to introduce and show my support for the great work that's being done by the Oregon Department of Education and the Oregon State Treasury. In 2015, you'll recall you passed Senate Bill 447. It created the opportunity for the state of Oregon to invest in local school facilities and address deferred capital maintenance and capital construction costs for school districts around the state. You then subsequently authorized $126.2 million in state general obligation bonds under the Article 11P of the Oregon Constitution to fund the program. in what I think has been a fantastic partnership. The Oregon Department of Education and the State Treasury created what's called the Oregon School Capital Improvement Matching Program, otherwise known as AWESOME. This program is committed to investing in local communities and ensuring that all districts are treated fairly and equitably. While the type of investment that we're discussing here is new, we've been leveraging tools at the state level for some time to help Oregon school districts with their capital investments. For example, we have the Oregon School Bond Guarantee Program, which allows districts to use the state's credit rating to reduce the rates they pay for their own local bonds. This is a program, of course, that ensures that in the unlikely event that a school district defaults, the state will continue to provide payments to the investors. Districts, therefore, have lower borrowing costs because there's less risk to those that are buying the bonds. I'm pleased to report that since the beginning of the school bond guarantee program, no participating district has ever defaulted on their bonds. Assisting school districts in their capital needs, of course, is not only good for the schools, it's good for the communities in which those schools operate. The AWESOME program encourages voters to invest in their local school facilities because they know that their dollars will go farther as a result of the state match. We have found that too often communities are unable to afford the required increases in taxes necessary to fully fund improvements in their school districts. The AWESOME program provides millions of dollars in matching grants, rewarding local residents for investing in their school facilities with additional funds and giving communities a chance to do more with less. As the state treasurer, it's also part of my responsibility to make sure that funds are prudently managed, and we take our role in managing the state's debt very seriously. Under the AWESOME program, no funds are distributed to districts until all of the necessary agreements are in place. Additionally, we only distribute funds through reimbursement, so we know exactly how the funds are spent and we know what work has been completed. With these controls in place, the AWESOME program will continue to manage public funds both prudently and responsibly. During the election of last week, there were 22 school districts that came forward with bond measures on their local ballots. That's more than any election since the November 2008 election. Of those 22 districts, 13 districts approved their bond measures. $52.5 million in state funds will be provided to augment the $258 million in local general obligation bonds that were approved by the voters. I think this is really good news for the program, and as the program develops and more in school districts and more voters learn about this leveraging opportunity, we expect that we'll see more resources going to this critical type of improvement to school infrastructure. This will mean real critical improvements to school infrastructure as well as Oregon students. I think it's important for the health of our state to also be able to incentivize local investment in infrastructure, particularly school infrastructure. And we know that also means opportunities for job growth and economic development in these communities throughout Oregon. I'm very excited about the program, obviously. After all, it is an AWESOME program. And I'm really proud that the Treasury has been able to work with the Department of Education to make it happen. I stand here representing a number of people in the State Treasury, including Alice Bibler, who is sitting right over here, who does not want to be acknowledged, but she was extremely instrumental in the rollout of this program, along with the two gentlemen sitting to my left who are going to speak to you today as the true experts on this program. Thanks for giving me an opportunity to support this great program that you created and giving me an opportunity to come here and talk about it today. Gentlemen.
Thank you, members of the chair, or members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Rick Krager. I am the assistant superintendent for the Department of Education. With me is Michael Elliott. He is the school facilities coordinator that we have recently hired, and he has just done a tremendous job. And I want to first acknowledge the treasurer for being here today and the Treasury Department. They have been a phenomenal partner in this. We really could not have done this in any way without them. When this legislation was passed, one of the unique features about it is that it has to be done in correlation with
local elections. So those happen four times in a biennium. So it's not like your traditional program where you're able to go out and issue bonds for particular projects at a defined period in time. So when the legislation was passed, to be able to get that ready by November of 2015 was nearly impossible. But at the same time, we had to be thinking about the May of 2016 election, because if not getting out there and making commitments for that particular election, we would certainly be well behind in terms of trying to get this program up and running. So again, I just want to recognize the efforts of the Treasury Department. They have been phenomenal. I also would be remiss without recognizing some of our key partners, the Oregon School Board Association, as well as the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators and the Oregon Education Association. I know that they have members here today that are in the audience, and I just again want to recognize all the efforts that they have put forth. They've been part of our advisory committees. They've been part of the advocacy around this. They've been doing this a lot longer than I have. And again, I just appreciate all the efforts that they have put forth in making this program happen. Just in terms of a little bit of a genesis to Senate Bill 447 and a little background, in 2007, the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, as many of you are familiar with, completed a report as it relates to the seismic structural the ability of our schools to be able to manage through earthquakes, through tsunami, and we saw that in that report there were nearly $8 billion worth of replacement cost on many of these structures. So clearly, in 2007, with the report, there was recognition that we had to do and be able to invest in our facilities across the state. In 2010, we saw the Constitution was amended, as the Treasurer had addressed, to be able to provide opportunities through Article 11 of the Constitution to actually issue bonds to the Department of Education that would be used as a matching program. So this particular bond program that we're speaking to was actually made available in 2010 through the constitutional amendment. Then in 2013, through the creation of Senate Bill 540, we had a task force that worked very diligently in terms of providing recommendations on what this particular program might look like, how it would be administered, to provide guidance to the development of the Office of School Facilities, which is what Senate Bill 447 is actually created. So a lot of work has gone up to the point of the passage of Senate Bill 447, which, again, we were the proud owners of that at the beginning of 2015-17. And in that bill, just as a recap, essentially six different areas to focus on. Number one was the creation of an Office of School Facilities, a central hub in the Department of Education that could administer this particular program, as well as two other programs, and also provide much technical assistance throughout the state. That particular office was staffed with 4.5 FT, which I'm proud to say that we have been able to get about 50% of that office up and going in order to enable us to administer this program, as well as to begin implementing some of the other programs going forward. The second piece, again, is what we're speaking to today, is the AWESOME program, $126.2 million of bonding authority for this biennium, of which we have now allocated 52.5 through the first election cycle. The next piece was around technical assistance. Much of the recommendations from the task force was that we needed to be able to establish standards for facility assessments, long-range facility plans, as well as seismic assessments throughout the state. There needed to be standardization in which we conducted all of our work and all of the planning that goes into it. So again, this is a key element of the Office of School Facilities, which we're right in the middle of at this point, working with our advisory committee members and developing and adopting those standards, which leads to the next element of the legislation, which was technical assistance grants. And the department was allocated actually $2.5 million, and of that, 1.8 was dedicated to go to technical assistance grants that would be provided to our school districts across the state in being able to help them do these capital plans, to be able to do the technical assistance, the seismic assessments, all of the necessary work and planning that needs to be done to have a successful project. This particular program, we are very close to being able to roll out. Our plan is the first allocation of money will happen in September. So very, again, pleased with the efforts that's happened there. The last two items, the one was the Oregon Schools Facilities Database, and you may recall through Senate Bill 540, this was part of the mandate, but the question was, how do we continue to get better information about the state of our school facilities across the state? The Dagami report was very helpful. It provided us information, but it also recognized that there was a lot of specifics. There was a lot of deferred maintenance issues in our school facilities. There was a lot of areas that we needed to be able to continue to keep track of. So we have developed that database, are in the process of continuing to data populate it so that we will be able to come before you in the future and provide much better information about the progress that is being made. And then finally, the last program that was provided to the department was called the Hardship Fund. Legislation spoke specifically to having dollars available to help facilities that are more critical in nature, typically those issues that happen that you're unprepared for, things that don't necessarily get addressed with capital financing, to essentially have an emergency fund to be able to help a lot of the districts that were in a hardship. At this point, that particular program is not funded. It was meant to be funded with dollars that were left over from the facility grants of the state school fund. I can tell you, at least for this biennium, all those funds have been used, so we're not anticipating any additional dollars that would go to that hardship fund. So for the future, that will have to be a discussion about if and how much do we want to be able to invest in that particular program. So again, we've been very busy and just focusing on the AWESOME program in terms of some of the key results. We have established the advisory board for ODE. We've been working with all of our partners. We have great folks on board in terms of helping, providing advice. And as a result, we've been able to develop and adopt all the necessary administrative rules for these particular programs. We've created funding formulas and a priority list based on legislative guidance. The guidance in Senate Bill 447 is very specific. It tells us in terms of how much goes to priority list, how much goes to first in time. It also gives us the specifics on how the funding formula should be based. So again, to where we're targeting our very high poverty areas of the state, as well as those with low tax base that would have more difficulty in being able to issue their bonds. So again, that was a key piece of the legislation that we have been able to implement. We've mapped and implemented a good funding process, of which we've been successful in the first one in May. We've conducted funding commitments process, created a waiting list. We have all of our grant agreements in place, have been verified by the Department of Justice as well as our bond council. And we've essentially stood up a bond financing program in the Department of Education that did not exist before. And again, I give great credit to the Treasury's office and all their help. Mr. Chairman, I have staff has provided you a little one-page handout that really focuses more on the results of our first allocation, and the treasurer has done a great job in terms of highlighting that. But just to just recap real quickly for you, I think you will see in the map that we've seen a good disbursement of resources across the state. Again, we really wanted to be able to get out to those communities that would have some of the most difficult time in terms of passing bonds. As the treasurer said, we had 22 school districts that actually went out in the bond election with anticipation of actually having a commitment or a promise for a commitment. That's the highest since 2008. 13 of those districts passed, which is a slightly under 60%. The traditional historical rate of passage was approximately 51%. So again, a key piece of this legislation, how do we incentivize local voters to be able to pass bonds? One other note I should make. Four of the districts of the 13 that were awarded had not passed any capital bonds in the last 20 years. So again, reaching out to those communities that have traditionally not been successful. I want to be mindful of your time, Mr. Chairman, and again, the handout provides you some highlights of some of the projects that we've been able to focus on and some of the areas that these monies will go into. But what I do want to really leave you with is, I think, something that is often overlooked. I mean, we talk about the benefit in which this particular program brings to our schools. We obviously have a great deal of deferred maintenance that needs to be addressed. We have schools that are at risk. We've seen that through many of our reports and our seismic assessment. But the other piece, the other additional benefit, is the economic activity that it brings. Again, with $52.5 million $52.5 million of bond proceeds, we're going to see $258.3 million of local bonds. So again, that's a pretty significant return when you do the math on that of about for every $1 of state, you get $5 of local return. In addition, when you put the multiplier effect of economic stimulus to this, and what we see with these traditional projects is about one for every $1 you're getting about $1.45 in economic return. So again, I know I'm shooting a lot of different numbers at you, but the one thing I want to leave you with, and I just did a little bit of the back of the napkin adding here, and for the $52.5 million that we invested just in this one election, total economic activity and leverage about $709 million. That's about $13.50 for every dollar that we put in from a state standpoint. I think that's a pretty good return. I think it's a good investment. It's a good use of state dollars. I can assure you that the department is extremely excited about this. We're committed. We're excited about the future of both the technical assistance program as well as the AWESOME program. And again, I know the communities out there are very, very grateful for the investment that you made. So, Mr. Chairman, I thank you for the opportunity to speak today and certainly would answer any questions that you might have and anything Michael might want to add.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Michael Elliott. I'm the school facilities coordinator, and I'm here to answer any technical questions you may have about the program.
So, any questions for this group? I just want to say that it's really been, it exceeded expectations from a perspective of a person that was looking at this. We haven't done a lot of investment in local schools. It's been the local schools really their responsibility to do all this. The treasurer has helped in the past with loans and other kinds of things. But when it first came up, people weren't certain that there would be enough request for it, and it's been interesting to see the overwhelming response from local districts now, which wasn't there a few years ago. I don't think it would have done as well, but I think with the reports that have come out from Dagami, from other kinds of things, I think everybody is recognizing that a big event like we are expected to have at some point in the future isn't going to just affect the coast. It's going to affect the whole state, and making sure your buildings are safe is a big community responsibility, and the fact that they're stepping up and that the state is working with them to step up, I think, is a really good thing. It is also good to have this kind of a conference information, because we passed the bill. We think it's pretty simple. You know, you got money for schools, go do it. And then we find out, God, there's a lot of things you had to do to make sure that happened. And we do appreciate the fact that afterwards we'll know exactly where it was spent and how it was done, which we probably as we pass the bill, we hope that would get done. But to hear about how thoughtfully it's been approached and how organizations within the government have worked together to make it work is heartening. And I appreciate that, because what I wouldn't want to see is that people go out and spend this, it doesn't get spent the right way, and all the stuff that goes, the kerfuffle that happens afterwards, which makes it so it's not possible to have the next round of events take place. It sounds as if we are on pretty stable grounds, that the future of this program is good, and that we as a legislature are going to have to face this issue that there may be more needs, since you say $8 billion worth of unmet net. This doesn't quite get there. Gets part of the first, you know, billion done when you take all of the money together. But the reality is there's a lot of work left to do. So that's my comment, and I want to thank you for coming. Thank you, Mr. Treasurer, for having the opportunity to come here and be a part of this, and I look forward to working with all of you. And it's nice the department now has this new facilities deal, and I understood there was no need for it before. That was never a part of what we did with our government, so it's nice to know that that's up and running as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. Have a great day. Thanks. Thank you very much. We're going to close our informational hearing on meeting of school facilities and expenditures. We're going to now open an informational hearing on healthcare workforce needs in Southern Oregon. I'll invite them up. Whenever it comes to having a new college or a new other kind of facility, it's always good to know what's happening educationally. We know that the healthcare issues in our state continue. continuously ask for more people. Our community colleges are always building new facilities for nursing and other kinds of stuff because we're always trying to keep up with the technology. So when I heard about this, I thought it would be good for just to get an impact of what's kind of going on and how are we getting the opportunity for another educational endeavor in the South of Oregon. So thank you. And I'll let you guys lead up however you want to do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Wayne Patterson. I'm the Executive Director for the Partnership for Economic Development in Douglas County. We are a collaborative organization focused on the retention, expansion, and recruitment of businesses in our regional area that provide family wage jobs. We are spearheading a new coalition, Oregonians for Rural Health, aimed at working to diversify the regional economy to ensure future prosperity and growth. Today, I'd like to provide a report on the state of Southern Oregon's economy as related to our workforce needs. For decades, Southern Oregon's economy thrived on timber and wood products, providing steady jobs handed down from one generation to the next. Yet logging restrictions, coupled with a range of other factors, have taken a significant toll on the industry and consequently the regional economy and our sense of community identity. The scars of high unemployment and poverty weathered over the years across Southern Oregon run deep. Today, jobs are still tough for many to come by, and the future remains uncertain. New economic drivers are needed that can provide greater stability. In addition, family wage jobs are critical to reversing the region's high unemployment and poverty levels. We formed a collaborative group of community leaders, businesses, and other several companies and organizations years ago to explore options. Capitalizing on healthcare came to the forefront, given its strong presence in the region and the growing need for services. But what became apparent is that there is not enough healthcare professionals to meet the community needs, despite recruiting efforts. No doubt, expanded workforce training in the region is needed to meet the growing labor demands of healthcare providers. And here it is that Southern Oregon's unemployment rates have remained high following the recession, despite improvements in other urban areas of the state. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that the national unemployment rate is at 5%. Oregon's unemployment rate is slightly better at 4.5%. The unemployment rate for Portland metro area is better at 3.9%. Yet the average unemployment rate for Southern Oregon counties is 6.04%. At the height of the recession, unemployment across Southern Oregon averaged nearly 16%, which is 10 points down from the recession, but still not good enough. Southern Oregon has historically had ups and downs in its regional economy, especially given the cyclical nature of the timber industry. Market conditions, including building booms and busts, largely drive production and consequently employment and revenue. Adding to the mix of uncertainty in this is the timber industry, particularly following environmental restrictions on logging in federal forests. Since then, limited timber supplies have added challenges to the industries and led to mill layoffs and closures. Timber supply remains in question today. Timber executives and county officials have just issued warnings that the latest BLM timber harvest plan will cut harvests to a point where further downsizing would be inevitable. Vanishing funds from the timber industry revenues are expected to lead to cuts in social services. And federal timber payments, which have sustained services, including schools, are expected to come to an end. What's more, investments in mill modernization and automation have increased output per worker while requiring fewer and fewer employees. What Southern Oregon communities needs are, what Southern Oregon communities need are long-term solutions that can help diversify our economy and that has led us to healthcare. Healthcare has continued to grow since the 90s, even during the recession. It's more recession-proof, vitality and strong, growing presence in our region offered the opportunity to get Southern Oregon back to work. According to Oregon Employment Department forecast, healthcare will add 45,000 new jobs at 22% growth rate through 2022. And it's not just the small number of healthcare occupations in which the demand is rising. The Oregon Employment Department projects growth in demand through 2022 for multiple healthcare occupations, many including nurse practitioners, physical and occupational therapists, and diagnostic imaging and radiology technicians are projected to increase in demand by over 20%. Healthcare is a viable path forward to strengthen and diversify Southern Oregon's economy. As hospitals and providers have told us, and the state data shows, job vacancies already exist in multiple high-end medical fields. The opportunity is to link individuals living in the region to those jobs through expanded workforce training. Our vision is to build a regional allied health medical college that would provide advanced training in multiple high-demand allied health medical fields. Students would come from community colleges and workforce training programs from within Southern Oregon, in addition to being drawn from other areas outside. The specific mix of programs offered by the college will depend on regional input, as well as the capacity of the academic partners secured to take the lead in shaping and administering the college. We are in the early stages of effort and need guidance and support from this legislature group to make this vision a reality. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Kelly Morgan. I'm the president and CEO of Mercy Medical Center in Roseburg. I've also served as the chairman of the Economic Development Corporation. I've also served as the chair of the Industrial Development Board, and I'm currently the chair of the Southwestern Oregon Workforce Investment Board, which is made up of Douglas, Coos, and Curry counties. Oregon's state economy has made great gains post-recession, yet Southern Oregon's economy continues to struggle and lag behind as it has for decades. As Wayne pointed out, our once robust timber industry has dwindled over the last 20 years, resulting in unemployment consistently higher than the state and national average. Federal timber payments have provided relief, and funding social services are likely to come to an end. And adding to the economic hardships, communities are facing growing shortages of healthcare professionals that limit access to critical healthcare services. Innovative solutions are needed, and put us on a path of prosperity and growth. We believe we have an innovative solution. Several years ago, community leaders, businesses, economic groups, educators, and others began exploring options to diversify our region's economy. Capitalizing on the strength and vitality of healthcare emerged to the forefront of one of the options that have a strong presence in our region. Healthcare has continually posted gains in job growth in the region and statewide since the 1990s and expected to maintain its steady expansion. Yet as regional health care providers, including our hospital in Douglas County, are struggling to recruit skilled professionals for numerous allied health positions, including nursing, physical and occupational therapy, radiology imaging, and mental health. That led us to the idea of building a regionally allied health medical college that would offer advanced training in multiple demand fields. We did conduct a detailed analysis of allied health professional needs covering our region, the western U.S. states, to determine which were in the high demand. I can tell you we started out with a need of 925,000 jobs on the West Coast in healthcare for the next 10 years. We took that 925,000, did our demand analysis, and actually got it down to 19 allied health occupations, which include nursing, pharmacy, radiology, laboratory, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and mental health. The specific mix will depend on regional input from regional educators, healthcare providers, and others, as well as the capacity of the academic partner that's secured to take the lead in shaping and administering the college. We expect about 1,700 initial students to start. Students would come from high schools, community colleges, and workforce training programs in addition to being drawn from other areas. Hospitals and providers would provide a pipeline of skilled professionals necessary to ensure access to care as the demand for services continues to grow. Local residents, including high school and community college students, can tap into the college as a pathway to secure family wage jobs. At a time when Southern Oregon has experienced a large exodus of youth and young families as we leave in search of educational opportunities and jobs elsewhere, we can give them a reason to stay. We are here today to offer a new path that creates educational workforce training opportunities to get Southern Oregon back to work in the growing healthcare industry while ensuring access to critical care. These economic and healthcare workforce challenges may impact many in Southern Oregon. Starting at the beginning of the year, we have built a broad coalition, Oregonians for Rural Health, dedicated to promoting the health and vitality of our rural communities, included our community leaders, healthcare providers, educators, and economic groups. And I believe all of you do have a copy of our support letters, which includes the county commissioners from Douglas County, plus other commissions within Southern Oregon, mayors and city managers, highlighting the city of Brookings. If you look at that letter from the mayor, where they are in critical need of health care folks to take care of the residents. Hospitals and health care providers, we have letters of support from every hospital in Douglas, Coos, and Curry County. For any of you that are a golfer, I want to point out that in talking to my colleague in Bandon, he's been there 3 years, and he would thought with the world-class golf course, a beautiful coastline, that he could recruit staff. He struggles more than anybody to get staff to come to his hospital. Educators, we all have some support from Umpqua Community Colleges, as well as Southwestern Oregon Community Colleges and other businesses and economic groups. Healthcare demand has spiked in recent years and is projected to keep growing. National healthcare reforms have connected large numbers of individuals with an array of services. Almost 95% of Oregonians now have health insurance. Plus, a silver tsunami of soon-to-be-retired baby boomers with increasing health care needs will put a greater strain on our health care system. Mercy, like other health care providers, have expanded services in multiple times in numerous areas, including cardiac care, rehabilitation therapy, orthopedics, and imaging, just to keep pace with our growing needs. We've added more physicians and medical staff, but it's increasingly difficult to fill positions, especially in the allied health fields, including nursing, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and certain types of radiology and lab techs. We've greatly expanded our recruitment efforts, signing bonuses, loan repayment programs, externships, but recruiting continues to be an ongoing struggle, especially as we compete with Portland and the other urban areas. Mercy is not alone, as confirmed as in the Oregon Employment Department's 2015 job vacancy report released last March. Year over year, Oregon's healthcare industry has topped the list of total job vacancies in the state. Rates of difficult to fill job healthcare job vacancies are especially high in rural areas and expected to get worse. The primary reason cited for healthcare job vacancies is the lack of qualified candidates. What we need is a regional pipeline of skilled healthcare professionals, which is a allied health medical college can provide. Those who train in rural areas are more likely to stay and work in rural areas than those trained in urban areas. So for us to be successful, we really do need your assistance and help. One of the key factors for us is finding an academic partner that's based here in Oregon. Now, there's a lot of discussion and a lot of debate in regards to the expansion of the Affordable Care Act and more people having health insurance. And, you know, there's this little buzz that's going around in healthcare that, well, let's get paid for value rather than volume. My viewpoint as a healthcare professional is it doesn't really matter to me of what the model is. If we don't have workers to take care of our patients, it really doesn't matter. So we're in desperate need to make sure we have qualified applicants to take care of our patients, especially in rural Oregon, and look forward to working with all of you on this project.
All right, good afternoon. My name is Douglas Paxton. And I'm the director, medical center director for the Roseburg VA Healthcare System, serving our nation's heroes. I'm responsible for providing leadership, strategic direction to a healthcare system that covers a large catchment area. We have our main medical campus in Roseburg. We have a just opened 120,000 square foot healthcare center in Eugene, Oregon. And we also have two community-based outpatient clinics, one in Brookings and one in North Bend. We serve over 26,000 veterans annually. Last year, we had over 270,000 visits to our healthcare systems by our nation's heroes. I've been in the VA healthcare system in various capacities since the year 2000. Most importantly, I'm a veteran. I get my care to VA. I'm a service-connected veteran. I served 6 years in the Army Infantry. Assuring appropriate health care resources, access, and delivery in isolated rural communities remains a profound challenge for the nation's health care system, as well as the national VA's health care system. And rapidly growing and distinctive issues faced by veterans in rural settings are especially complex and daunting. According to the VA Office of Rural Health, most prevalent barriers to care across all studies include transportation to VA facilities, distance to VA facilities, lack of telehealth services in rural VA facilities, a lack of specialty care and urgent care at rural VA facilities, inadequate knowledge of VA eligibility benefits and service, and difficulties in recruitment and retention of health care providers, including allied health professionals. Access to a full and comprehensive spectrum of appropriate quality health care services is a central challenge facing many rural communities. veterans' rural health care needs, especially among returning Operation Iraqi Freedom, Operation Enduring Freedom veterans. Present our communities, veterans, and their families, and the Veterans Health Care Administration with additional distinctive challenges. Access is the key issue and are often more complex and multifaceted in a rural healthcare setting. Access to primary care and specialty care can be increased if we could establish and maintain a professional workforce for healthcare workers. Leveraging local infrastructure is an important strategy for providing healthcare to rural veterans. A partnership with a local college that could focus on the needs of the healthcare industry is greatly needed by our veteran community. We have specialized needs for our veterans. Homelessness, post-traumatic stress disorder. We have a RANGE program that provides mental health services to veterans in their community, which reduces admissions to the VA hospital. And we have many allied health professions that are hard to fill, including physical therapists, occupational therapists, nurses, LPNs, certified nursing assistants, medical technologists, diagnostic radiologic technologists, pharmacists, psychology professionals, and other mental health professions. Recently, we had a phlebotomist opening in Brookings. It took us 15 months just to hire a phlebotomist out there. Currently, there are approximately 26 million living veterans in the United States, with about 6.1 million living in rural areas. When measuring access to mental health services to veterans, rural areas typically rank lowest. The Roseburg healthcare system and also the White City healthcare system down in Medford have some of the lowest ranking scores in access to mental health in the entire VA system, also in primary care and specialty care. Given the increasing prevalence of PTSD among our veteran population and the often accompanying outcomes of suicide, substance abuse, domestic violence, and homelessness, the ability to see a provider trained in addressing PTSD and other mental health illnesses is critical. It is worth noting that while homelessness has historically been significant and more prevalent in the urban veteran populations, the issue is becoming an increasing concern in suburban and rural areas. Lingering effects from PTSD are often attributed as a significant cause of veteran homelessness, and the lack of access to trained professionals in rural areas may be a contributing factor to the observed increase in homelessness in these areas. Access to professionals trained in PTSD, homelessness, and other mental health issues are inconsistent. A healthcare college could provide the community with the skilled pool of professionals. While VA has the most extensive expertise in evidence-based treatments for combat-related PTSD, this expertise is not routinely accessible in many geographic areas, and the civilian provider community remains largely untrained in the unique aspects of PTSD in the military veteran community. Additionally, veterans of both sexes, but particularly female veterans, encounter more challenges due to potential effects of military sexual trauma, known as MST, on development and severity of PTSD. The Institute of Medicine has recently cited MST as an important risk factor for PTSD development in female service members in a VA research study from 2008 showed a 59% increase for mental health problems for women who experienced MST and a 40% increase risk for men. Accordingly, there is a need for trained mental health and primary care providers who are sensitive to the role of MST in the broader issue of PTSD and related mental health disorders. This need is particularly acute in rural areas where the population of female veterans is rapidly increasing. The Roseboro Healthcare System currently has over 1,400 female veterans enrolled in our system. You know, the veteran community in Roseburg desperately needs a medical college that could have trained professionals to help treat veterans. Thank you.
Any questions of this group?
Maybe a comment or two, Mr. Chair. I'm somewhat familiar with this project. And in fact, I think, Mr. Chair, we're going to have a presentation at the Coastal Economic Summit on this as well, which is incredibly appropriate because the need on the coast is acute. We know that. I just want to say that the city of Roseburg is uniquely situated and ready for this. The land is available. And for a community, I mean, we want to talk about unemployment. If you want to talk about, unemployment and underemployment were over 20% in Douglas County. What this would do for our community would be massive. And also what's interesting is downtown Roseburg has become somewhat of a ghost town, and this would revitalize everything. So, I mean, besides the fact that the need for these healthcare professionals is acute and apparent, this would be economic spark for a community that at one point in time was called the timber capital of the nation and no longer is.
And I want to say, this was, when I first started having a conversation about this, I wanted to highlight the fact that our local communities in these rural areas, and in this particular case, Douglas County, but it includes Coos and Curry.
All of Southern Oregon, actually.
And all of Southern, yes, right, all of Southern Oregon.
All of Southern Oregon.
We are working hard as community members to try to come up with ways to diversify our economy. It's not that we're sitting down there waiting for people to hand out. We have actively engaged people looking at what it can happen. And I really felt this would be a good way to highlight the fact that we are looking outside of ourselves, the research you provided. We're looking everywhere to say what are the kinds of things that we could actually use to diversify and meet the need of our local citizens, both in jobs that are there and in places for education to take place for our kids. And when I heard about this, it became clear that it really does tie to the education committee in a whole lot of ways, because we're education and workforce development. And this is really about workforce, but it's more than that. It's really about how our communities are trying to cope with the situation we're in today and not look back to the past to try to solve the problem, but to look forward to a future that could make it better for all of us. And I agree with you in Roseburg in particular, having the facility there would be a really great building place for the rest of the community. So it was good to have you guys come and explain what you have done to get to where you are now. It's not like you came up with a crazy idea. It's the idea that you looked at it, researched it, recognized that you had facilities that could use the workers that you were providing there, and come up with a plan. Well, I hope we can continue to work in trying to find that educational institution that you can work with. And as you come up with ideas of where we can help, let us know, and we'll try to help provide some things.
Just, Mr. Chair, to piggyback on what you were saying, you know, I mean, we're also being very aggressive in what we're trying to bring in, for example, the Port of Coos Bay, and
That's
make
right.
that an incredibly viable
yep.
Western port. I do want to say that when Kelly approached me about this several years ago, I thought he was crazy, but he turned out to be a really good crazy in this case. And you know, they have done their homework on this. They truly have. I mean, they have put in the due diligence on this, and I have been sold on this for quite a while now. And actually, it's not just Southern Oregon that benefits; Northern California as well would benefit from this as well.
Yeah. Any other questions for group? Again, thank you for taking your time and coming here. It's a fairly easy drive compared to those of us that have to come across from the coast. But you know, that Roseburg drive up here is we do appreciate the fact you're willing to put your time in and be here. So with that, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close our informational hearing on healthcare and workforce, and we're going to open informational meeting on the new path of assessment. And I have had the opportunity to watch some of this happening, and I'm really excited about it. So open that committee, and we'll start out with Hannah Vanderling. And anybody you want to bring with you, Hannah. Or you can be all there by yourself, however you want to do that.
People we've never seen before.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, my name is Hannah Vandering. I'm an elementary physical education teacher and president of the Oregon Education Association. And I want to thank you for the opportunity to share a little more information on the new path forward. It's 2 years of collaborative work that we are extremely proud of as an organization. And we believe that the stars have really aligned right now for Oregon to truly lead the way in education. Because of the 2 years and the collaborative work that we've done, we can work together in order to build the system of assessment that our students truly need and also lift up the voice of parents and educators and put that local control back into our schools. So I want to share just a little bit. It appears we do have the PowerPoint. I didn't think we were going to have that. Okay.
Anything to make it easier for you.
Yeah. Boy, I didn't know that was coming. How great. So A New Path Forward was truly a collaborative effort with the governor's office, the chief education officer, the Department of Education, the Oregon Education Association. We had 16 educators who were on this team who truly dug into exactly what it means to have a balanced system of assessment for students in Oregon. We were also privileged to have Dr. Rick Stiggins, as we call him, Citizen Stiggins, work with us, an incredible advocate for our students and getting assessments right in our school. So we brought forward the New Path Forward document. And as I shared, the opportunity of a lifetime with the reauthorization of ESEA to the Every Student Succeeds Act, we see that lifting up the voice of educators and putting family and partnerships with the community back into our schools so that we can look at what our students really need. As Senator Beyer, I think you asked a question about assessments and what we're looking at. And there, ESSA calls for an assessment audit that we believe will be extremely helpful for us to be able to understand what we're doing currently and then look at what we should be doing for our students. The goal, so I'm going to give you a short little overview of the path forward. The path forward had goals set forward by the team that we wanted to accomplish to create a balanced system of assessment, and that came out over and over again about what does balance look like and how do we make sure that the time that we're spending on assessments truly is helping our students. We wanted to reduce the emphasis on high-stakes standardized tests that, as I think was shared earlier today, when you see the students coming back in tears or you hear the stories about the impact that it has on their learning, it's problematic. We wanted to increase assessment for learning and of learning through the work that we are doing in A Path Forward. And finally, we wanted to create a foundation and the supports necessary for understanding assessment at all levels. So whether it's an educator, a parent, a student, a legislator, a community member, we want to make sure that everyone understands the system of assessment that we're using and how it will help our students. This is our team. And we're, like I said, we're extremely proud of the team that worked on this. After we were done doing the first draft, we went out in the field and had forums across the state. We had over 800 Oregonians bring forward their thoughts about the document that we had shared with them and the recommendations. There were 12 recommendations that went forward. And through that, we heard a lot from Oregonians. And as Dr. Nora shared through the forums that are being done through ESSA, we have Oregonians sharing information. What we did with the voices from the field is we use Google Docs until we can show people what we heard. And then to go a step further, which we often ask people what they think, but we went the step further that's important to share what changes we were going to make in the document because of what we heard and the additions that we were making to ensure that their voice was in this work that we are going to be doing in our public schools. The goal of this was really to go from where we believe that we currently were with assessments to where we wanted to be. We can't change the past, but we can certainly build a better future for our students. So I won't read through these to you. I think we've talked about the current state of assessments in Oregon, and we've talked about a vision, the hopes and dreams of our students and our educators. If we believe that students are important in their own education, then we need to ensure that assessments are used and that they understand their role. I want to appreciate again the fact that we passed the Student Assessment Bill of Rights here in Oregon. We're the only state that has that, really lifting up the importance of students in their own learning. The next information that I'd like to share with you is what we're doing now. What are the next steps? So we've shared the path forward with you. It came with 11 recommendations in its final form. And so what OEA is doing in collaboration with our partners is, number one, we've created assessment cadre members. We have 10 teachers and a team from St. Helens, really excited about that team from St. Helens. It has administrators and teachers who are working together to do an extremely deep dive into assessments and how we actually are using assessments in our schools and what we can do differently. They have a professional learning community, and you've heard, I'm sure, PLCs bantied about and how that's going in our schools. When you have a quality professional learning community in a school where the educators are truly engaged in the conversation about what's happening with their students and the information that's most useful to them, it is so powerful. And so this group is using professional learning communities. Also, Action Research, they are out in the field. When I went into their last meeting, there was a group sitting on the floor talking about a second grade lesson and what they had done and what worked and what didn't work. There was a group outside that was talking about a high school lesson that was used and the feedback that they had. So this group, we are looking to prepare them for going out in the field next year to be able to help other educators across the state. So our assessment cadre. Next, we have a policy and practice think tank. And I believe we have a member of our policy practice think tank in the room today. This is a group of members and leaders from across the state who are truly digging into information that we have about education, what's the research is telling us and how we in Oregon can use that research to ensure that our system, our balanced system of assessment, is one that we can be proud of and one that is innovative and truly understands the breadth of our student population and how this assessment system impacts each and every one of those. They will make policy recommendations to OEA and be able to share information with other stakeholders around education so that we are not only just seeing that research is out there but actually utilizing it. Next, we have our assessment toolkit. The Center for Great Public Schools at OEA, we're working together with other partners to have, number one, a definition of assessment literacy. And what does quality assessment look like? How do we promote effective professional learning across the state? You can talk about having time, professional development in your school calendar, but if it's not planful and thoughtful in meeting the needs of educators, then it's not really a quality use of time. We want to deepen the instructional practices that all educators are using, and also, again, go back to helping others who aren't in the classroom, who aren't working with students every day, understand the system of assessment. We look forward to having this by the fall of 2016. We're working on getting input on that, as with all of the documents that we're using. The next piece of work is with ESSA. So we have, as Dr. Noor shared, we have the four work groups. There are educators on each one of those, and I want to thank all of the Oregonians who are spending time on those work groups to really share their voice. The four work groups you've already heard about, we're working closely with the Department of Education and with COSA on the work that we're doing internally on the Every Student Succeeds Act. We believe at OEA that the most important component of ESSA is to ensure that at the local level, everyone understands the impact and the local decisions that will be now coming back to them, so that when it's time to actually engage in those conversations, everyone has the information available to them, and that we don't have OEA send out information to our leaders and COSA send out information to administrators, and they're not aligned so that we have arguments at the local level. We think that in Oregon, again, because of the relationships that we have and because we all believe that our students are the focus of what we should be doing in our public schools, that we can have a common voice and really make sure that this implementation goes smoothly. We're doing a training in Portland, June 21st through 23rd. NEA is coming out to help the whole Pacific region, but OEA, we've been really advocating for training for local leaders, so we will share all of that information out with our partners along the way. Next, House Bill 2680. As you're aware, we passed House Bill 2680 in 2015. This task force has been convened to look at and determine how to implement the results of Smarter Balance and how the implementation went of Smarter Balance that first year that we implemented. We helped do a survey on this. We reached out to educators, and that's been used. The task force is working. This task force will be making recommendations to the state board and the legislature on moving forward with the Smarter Balanced assessment. OEA has never come out and said that there should not be summative assessments. What we've said very clearly is we believe that that summative assessment actually has to measure what we want to measure, and it has to give us information back. The data that we get back has to be useful for the students, the educators, and the parents. So we look forward to the recommendations that come out of that. And finally, I think, again, going back to Oregon leading the way, I'm excited to be sitting here with our chief education officer and our deputy superintendent of public education and talking about the opportunity that we have together, the work that we've done so far together, and what we will do moving forward to ensure that each and every student, wherever they live in Oregon, has access to a quality public education that uses assessments appropriately and promotes their learning. So I appreciate your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions when it's appropriate.
Okay. We'll let each person speak first, and then we'll have questions, unless there's anybody that has a question now. Okay.
Chair Roble and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lindsay Capps, Chief Education Officer and Education Policy Advisor to Governor Brown. I just want to commend the work that has happened through the auspices of the Center for Great Public Schools and OEA, which has really been driven by practitioners. And I think an important principle of this work when it began with Dr. Golden, when she was Chief Education Officer, is that really sound practice ought to inform policy. And I think we're seeing an opportunity here where that teacher voice and educator voice is helping to inform the work that we're trying to build at the state level. I want to give Salam an opportunity really to talk a little bit more about this work. You've heard already about the work around ESSA, and much of this rests within the Department of Education to sort of implement. But I'll speak just briefly to the role that the Chief Education Office is playing from a coordinating, convening, and research perspective. And that is really for us to look at this work as from a systems perspective. And there are a couple of, I think, key framing questions that we're looking at as we partner with ODE, with OEA, and other partners on this. And the first is really, how do we build system capacity to support educators using these authentic classroom assessments? And that's a big piece of the conversation as we think about educators devising these what are really diagnostic tools to help them in their instructional practice. And the second question is, how do we ensure that educators are skilled in utilizing these assessments? And that's a conversation that really spans beyond the K-12 system, but also thinking about our teacher preparation programs and how we are building that assessment literacy and knowledge in pre-service programs across the state. And I think importantly, the last piece, and I think this is tied to the work around the Every Student Succeeds Act, is how these classroom-based assessments, formative and interim assessments, really tie to our accountability system, which is based on our summative assessment statewide. And what's the relationship? And in looking at that particular question, we really get to a definition of what a balanced assessment system looks like. And I think the work group spent a lot of time thinking about how those different assessments can work together in important ways. We have worked to convene through our office, through our research unit, what we call a sort of assessment literacy team, and it's really building off the work of the educators that came together to make the initial recommendations. And that group is now inclusive of school administrators through the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, Chalkboard Project, Oregon School Boards Association, the Northwest Evaluation Association, the Education Service District. So all of these organizations that are now supporting this work in the field, we've sort of brought them together to say, so do we have a common definition of what assessment literacy looks like within your individual efforts? And hopefully in the process of that convening, we can, I think, come to some common standards and practices that are recognized across the system. And that really gets to that first question of how we build system capacity. The second piece is really to use that. You mentioned action research earlier. Really use that knowledge as it's being implemented in the field to help us inform these questions and to inform the department in its broader policy work. So we've got a lot of work to do. We've had two meetings. We will have more. And we recognize that even as we're meeting with these partners, these practitioners in the field who bring a lot of expertise, we have an additional step. And I think this came up in some of the conversations last session, which is to really think about how we're engaging communities around the value and purpose and use of these assessments so there's greater understanding of it. That's a critical piece that students and parents understand, how these are really critical pieces of the instructional learning process. So look forward to coming back and reporting more on our particular piece of this, and turn it over to Salam for additional testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon again. Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, Salam Noor, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction. I am really delighted to be here today, joined with my colleagues, to talk about something that we all care deeply about and we know will have a tremendous impact on our system and our students in particular. I'm happy to expand on the work that the Department of Education is currently engaged in to support the new path for Oregon, and mainly to support student-centered assessments for learning. And that's essentially what Hannah talked about, and that's what we have many educators advocating for and working on. And I'm happy to address how some initiatives, both legislatively enacted and work that we regularly do relative to assessment, connects with this work, aligns with it, and gives us opportunities to work together in a very focused and intentional way to support our educators and students. Earlier, I described the four ESSA work groups. Hannah alluded to those in her presentation as well. And I'm delighted to say that we are building on our culture of collaboration. I mean, this is really the way to do business in Oregon. We convene stakeholders, we listen to them, we engage each other, and we collectively inform the work that we forge forward with. Just want to share with you that information collected from the ESSA standards and assessment work groups, the community forums I described earlier, legislative initiatives that I'll touch on here briefly, has made it clear to us that there is a need for a balanced statewide assessment system and resources, most importantly, to support local capacity to actually implement such systems. ODE is addressing those issues and will continue to advocate for the necessary resources and policy infrastructure to support local efforts, and that means supporting teachers and educators in building their skills and knowledge and ability to deliver those systems, and that's part of the assessment literacy work that both Hannah and Lindsay referred to. In addition, the flexibility afforded through the ESSA and systems accountability will allow us to rethink how we use assessment results and perhaps take aggressive steps, and I want to underscore aggressive steps, to minimize the overall testing footprint. And this is something that you asked me about earlier in our conversation. And that's really relative to systems accountability requirements. So it's not exclusively based on testing, as I mentioned earlier, and that allows for a much broader, more meaningful conversation. And we really put assessment in the appropriate context. So items that the ESSA work group is considering, including the opportunity to use alternative assessments at the high school level, such as ACT, SAT, and perhaps others, as well as interim assessments, which could be used in aggregate for systems accountability purposes, meaning using local assessments that we can use for accountability purposes without compromising the whole purpose of that assessment or the essence of that assessment and what we use it for. And that allows schools and districts some flexibility on using formative, interim, and other types of assessment. I also want to add that the work group has been very clear about the need for a balanced assessment system that includes formative and interim assessments aligned to standards which inform the teaching and learning process in meaningful ways. And that's really what the new path for Oregon is all about. It's about making education local, it's putting it in the hands of teachers and making it really relevant to students because they see the result of their assessment and how they can improve on it. Hannah alluded to assessment audits, and I want to say that the legislature was even more visionary than the federal government, and you directed us to do two assessment audits. One of them is part of House Bill 2680, and we've convened a group that has partners from OEA, COSA, and practitioners. to evaluate the technical quality of state English language arts and math tests, as well as the student learning gaps and instructional implications. So this really gets at the core of the purpose of assessment. Similar to ESSA work group, this group has identified the need for local capacity building, such as assessment literacy that you heard about, and the need for a statewide balanced assessment systems. Under House Bill 2713, the Secretary of State's office has completed an audit of the state assessment program for English language arts and math, and we will share the results of that assessment with you. We will use that information to help inform our work moving forward. So the work being done at ODE is compatible and aligned with our partners. I agreed with Hannah that the stars are aligned, and I'm really delighted to have the opportunity to work with her and colleagues such as her and Lindsay and many of the educators that we engage around this process. But we're committed to build a system of assessments that supports teaching, learning, and student success, and not just testing for the sake of testing or testing exclusively for accountability purposes. But really, it's about assessment for learning more than anything, while we focus on achievement and do still measure how the system is doing, but not confuse those two or lose one in the interest of the other. So thank you very much for the opportunity to share some information, and be happy to take any questions.
Any questions? I guess the point I would make, and I know that in the last session, the conversations about opt-out were not easy conversations with lots of different groups, and I know the federal government got involved. But the reality is, I am hopeful that we're actually having the real conversation we should have had. I mean, opt-out was the only way parents had to say, I don't like what's happening to my kid. And people weren't listening very well, in my opinion, around the state. We had parents who had special needs children who were watching their kids be hurt and harmed by the system that's supposed to be helping. And I am excited about what I'm hearing, because this is the kind of testing that parents want. I mean, they want to be informed of what things they can help their kid be better at than their child. They don't want their testing to just be a way to evaluate the whole system. I mean, that doesn't make any sense to them, and if it takes very much time, it doesn't make any sense to them, because they know their children need to be in a classroom with a teacher in front of them educating them. And so if this helps that conversation so that we don't ever have to have the other conversation again, because what we're doing is in the best interest of our kids every day, as opposed to not so much sometimes, in my opinion, it will have been well worth the battles and the fights and the confusion that people had around something like that. And at the same time, if it is really balanced, it will point out where we're not doing what we should be doing. And that is important. We can't, cloud that over. And I think people thought that one big formative assessment was going to do that. It doesn't. And I think hopefully we've figured that out. And I appreciate you working together. I appreciate the fact that not only are you working together, but there's a bigger group, a bigger community out there that mm-hmm. is trying to have that same conversation. So thank you for that. Yes.
Senator Roblin, to your point, I think we still do have the issue with opt-out. We're not past it,
right.
But I think
I
that is absolutely the vision. Opt-out is not the answer. The answer is creating a balanced system of assessment, and I think that's – so thank you for your support in us doing that.
Any other questions or concerns? So I will tell you that as a committee, I will continue to watch you guys and how it's going, because I really want to see it work, and I want to hopefully hear from parents that, wow, this is really great. I know what my child's doing and what they're learning, and now I know they're not working hard enough, because they've got to get a lot farther if we expect them to be where they want to be in the future, and that we'll have an answer for some of those things through the assessment process. So
no pressure.
No pressure.
Okay.
We'll just watch it really closely.
Okay.
We'll point it out if we know things that are bothering us. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much.
We do appreciate it. With that, we will close our informational hearing on new path up to assessment. And we will close that one. And we're going to open informational meeting on update on poverty funding guidelines. Just so people know, we have had a number of school districts. Some have been really happy. Some have not been so happy. The federal government changed some rules on us with regard to how we identify what poverty is in the schools, and we've gotten pretty used to what it was before, and it hasn't gone as smoothly as we had hoped, and I hope we can figure out ways in which, having been a high school administrator, surprises in the middle of a system when I already have my teachers hired is never a fun thing, trying to figure out, especially if I'm losing. If I'm gaining, it's really kind of a fun thing. if I'm losing, and when you're in a district who had generally had an ongoing event each year of less kids, it was not enjoyable. So with that, I think people have had a misunderstanding of where we're going and why we're at where we are. And I just thought it would be really better, and I had a couple of members ask me, do we really understand this? Because my superintendents are rather uptight about what happened to them this time, and other people were being very quiet because it was going really well for them. So thank you for being here to explain.
Thank you, Chair Roland. For the record, my name is Mike Wilfong. I'm the Director of School Finance and School Facilities with the Department of Education. And I think Senator Roland did a nice job of kind of summarizing that. I'll go into a little bit further detail with some of the history because I think that will help understand where we were, where we are, lessons learned, and then moving forward. Prior to 2013, we used decennial census data, and again, the poverty data was updated every 10 years. With that data, we coupled that with free and reduced lunch data for districts that had less than 2,500 ADM. The idea being is that the federal census sampling may not be as detailed enough to get to some of the smaller districts. But what we found with that, and then we adjusted we prorated the decennial census data with the ADM. And so there really wasn't an accurate way to capture the recessions that we saw in the last recession with the 2002 and, of course, 2008. So the message that we had coming out of when we found out that the decennial census data was no longer available, in 2013 we asked the legislature to change the funding formula for poverty. And one of the messages that we heard is that we want to see much more accurate data, more timely data, especially in light of the recession that we just went through. And so moving forward, that's exactly what we did. We looked to a widely accepted model, the SAPI model, which is the small area income poverty estimate. And that's a source of poverty data that is widely used even for the Department of Education with our Title I grants, our poverty. So we felt that we had an excellent source of information as far as the identifying poverty. And that was really coming to the formula and the timelines with implementing that. Initially, when we rolled the new formula in, the idea is that we would mirror similar updates as what we do with other data elements in the state school fund, with average daily membership, English language learners, parenting in poverty, and what have you. And what we found is that the districts, because they were so used to the poverty being relatively flat, they recommended that we only make two updates during the lifespan of the state school fund. And keep in mind that the lifespan of the state school fund is roughly about 30 months or almost 30 years. And so we agreed, we heard that message, and so we went back and we changed the rule to, instead of updating it three times through the life cycle of the state school fund, we would just update it twice. And that's what happened when we updated recently in the 15-16 school year. 14-15 was the first year that we rolled that in, and there wasn't a lot of substantial change. But, of course, with Oregon's economy being one of the hottest in the nation, we're seeing the poverty rates starting to come back down as a state, as well as pockets, especially in Lane County, that are seeing a faster reduction in their weights than in other areas of the state. In fact, Beaverton, for example, had an increase in their poverty weights. And so in my mind, when I asked, you know, I responded, you know, was I surprised that we saw this increase in the decrease in the weights for the poverty funding? And I said, no, I wasn't surprised because of the rate of our economy recovery. Granted, we were sympathetic to some of those districts around the state that were losing funding. And so we actually went to the Confederation of School Administrators, Oregon School Administrators, COSA, and we met with the superintendents to get their opinion. And by a show of hands, we asked, should we change the formula? And at that time, there wasn't any interest in that group to change the formula. However, again, in conversations with a number of the school business officials, especially the business managers, they're recommending that they would like more predictability and stability with this data element, which we understand. And so we're willing to move forward with a work group this summer to get input on that. One of the suggestions has been made, instead of updating it two times in the life cycle of state school fund, that we would just update it the one time. The challenge with that is, with updating one time, because of the timing of the data, for example, use the 15-16 school year. We just rolled the update from December of 15. That data is actually from the 2014 school year. By the time we reconcile the state school fund for the 15-16 school year, it'll be May of 2017. So if we had only updated that, so in that in itself is, you know, roughly a three-year span. If we go to just a one-year update, it'll be actually a four-year difference between when the actual data and when we're updating in the state school fund. As we all know, recessions tend to last only a 2 to 3 years. And so if we're trying to find a more accurate data to try to get the weights to account for poverty, we'll actually we'll have less accuracy by having more predictability and stability in the state school fund. So that's one area of caution I would move forward. Again, we're interested in convening a work group this summer to meet with a number of interested parties around the state and to have this reviewed. We do have a case study. There was asked to take a look at Springfield, and so we do have a case study. And to my right is Michael Elliott. Currently, he's a school facilities coordinator, but prior to that role, he was also the state school fund coordinator and is very familiar with the poverty and the funding formula. So we'll go ahead and turn it over to Michael with regarding this, the case study, and hopefully this will answer some of your questions.
So, Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Elliott. I'm the school facilities coordinator, formerly the state school fund coordinator. So what I'm showing is how this update works. So districts are very used to an update mid-year. When we start the year, we fund based on district-supplied estimates of their average daily membership, their ADMR, their special education count, their pregnant and parenting counts, their ELL counts, and other counts that make up their weights that drive their funding formula. When we move through the year, we get second period data. And what that data is, that's counting September to December, actual student attendance, actual counts for ELL, actual counts for pregnant and parenting. So we make an update saying, well, even 2 months or two quarters of actual counts is better than a projection based on, they're very good projections, but still actual data is better than a projection. And then when we do the reconciliation, that full 30-month calendar, we're taking annual ADM and actual financials and then doing the final calculations. So districts are used to these type of updates happening mid-year. And this is an example of one district that saw a drop in their poverty weights from the estimated data to the second period data and the second adjustment of poverty. But as you can see, there are a lot of weights changing in this estimate. So their ADMR actually increased by 70 weights, close to 70 weights. Special education increased by 6 weights. Their ELL increased by 17.879 weights, and then pregnant parenting also increased as well as foster care. The one weight that went down was poverty. But as a result of all of these changes, the district only saw a net loss of about 47 weights. And at $7,000 a weight, I'm going to round up to 50 weights, that's about $350,000. Given that it's a 13,000 weight district on that's about $100 million budget, it's a relatively minor adjustment for that size of district. And the other case study shows that even if a district increases poverty, it may not be a necessarily good thing for this district. In this district, we noticed their ADMR, their estimate was significantly off for the size of this district. So even the change in poverty weights, the increase in poverty weights, they're still seeing a drop in weight. So a lot of the districts that said, well, I'm losing a direct dollar amount to the loss of poverty weights, that may not have been the case based on the final counts of all of their different weights changing. And the other thing to notice, to remember, is that districts that are in decline enrollment, and frankly any district, has what we call extended ADMW. And that's where we take the average daily membership weighted, all of the weights together of the prior year, and compare it to the current year. And the school district gets paid on the greater of those two. So if the district had a significant drop in poverty weights, their extended ADMW would stop that drop and would say, okay, we're going to limit you to this much, and this will be your floor, and this is what you'll get me funded at, so they can move forward and budget that way. But again, just showing through these two actual case studies using actual district data and actual changes from December to April estimates, we see a lot of weights changing for the district, since it's not simply the poverty weight changing, so there is other factors going on. And again, as Mr. Wiltfong stated, we're talking about tension between predictability and stability. Again, we currently update twice. The work group, we might look at updating once as we talk with a group, find out how we balance that tension between really accurate data, and that then having predictability. As Chair Roblin said, it's not pleasant to get a surprise mid-year when you spent, you know, you received 7/8 or, you know, 5/6 of your funding, and you have to make a change in the last 2 months. And so one proposal that's being floated, we haven't done a lot of research on this, we haven't talked with people, we are starting those conversation, is to look at, again, as Mr. Wolfong said, just do one update. So the 14 SAPI data would be the only poverty data that would go in for the 16-17 school year. Now, that's not to say poverty wouldn't change, because it still changes based on their ADMR as that goes through the cycle of a projection, then an estimate, then the actual. But the severity of poverty wouldn't change because that number would be frozen. And again, just a graphic visual of the potential caution there is, you know, this, notice I don't put any timelines on this. I'm not going to predict the economy in any way, shape, or form. But just if if the economy takes a downturn, we could be seeing where, you know, poverty data was reporting good times, and now you're down in not so good times. And how does that affect the weights and that sort of thing? So that's what we're going to be discussing with their work group and talking with superintendents and business managers about how best to handle this.
Senator Beyer.
Well, I guess I have a couple of observations, comments. You'd mentioned, I don't know how big the budget was you were talking about, but $350,000 swing in a year after you've done your budgets, that's like 350 teachers that you have to get rid of, and particularly if you get it like right now when you're already halfway into your budget planning for the next year. So I think there is a question. You seem to be addressing smoothing that out. I mean, it's too hard in all but the very largest school districts to make that kind of a swing in mid-year or almost any time, you know, because we've got, I know, I have a couple within my district, looking at the numbers, I have a couple of small districts that are getting a little more money, and I have a couple of bigger districts that are getting significant hits in money, and I think those are tough. Those are really hard to do there, and I've argued for years, I think when I last talked about this stuff was in 99, when I was on the revenue committee and we were looking at it. And we talked then when we were doing a significant change about smoothing that out or that to recognize it. So I think that's something you need to consider. It's just too hard. The other one is, and I have to admit, I don't really understand how you're doing the poverty piece. I know you're doing that and using the new data, but I have some credibility questions about the factor, recognizing it's not yours, it's the Fed's. It, as I was looking at all the school districts, it seemed to me that some of the areas of the state that were recovering had recovered the fastest and had the most robust economies had an increase in poverty, while some of the areas that haven't recovered at all, it made it look like they would have had increased or decreased in poverty. And I just have a credibility question about that.
Sure.
I recognize it's that I don't understand how the formula is working, but it didn't seem logical.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Roblin, Senator Beyer. Interesting conversation. And I agree that there's, depending on what you're comparing and looking at, for example, the argument is that, well, my poverty is going down, but my free reduced lunch is going up. And one concern there is that free reduced lunch, the free lunch is 130% of poverty, of the poverty definition, and of course the reduced lunch is 185% of the poverty definition, whereas the SAPI data that we're using is at the 100% level. A little background on the small area income poverty estimate. It uses information from the American Community Survey, the Annual Social and Economic Supplement and Current Population Survey, federal income tax returns, decennial census data, SNAP benefits, Bureau of Economic Analysis aggregate data, Social Security income, population estimates, and also other sources of data. So there's quite a bit of contributing factors in that data. I believe one of the challenges that we saw in one district that was questioning where they actually contacted the Feds, the federal government, the Census Bureau, that the Census Bureau responded back, and they believed that it was the respondents, the sampling, and in this particular district, it was believed that the population was fairly migratory and possibly even reluctant to participate in any type of surveys. And so trying to address that, and I don't know that if that's the case, even with free and reduced lunch data or other services, would they be willing to participate? So that's an interesting issue that we have to try to vet through in trying to identify those populations.
One of the issues you may be dealing with, too, is I know we're trying to find a metric that matches up to students who are in poverty. And you get into some of those areas, and by the sampling techniques, which I'm relatively familiar with, you're looking at a larger population, which may not be reflective of the student population at all.
Correct. Yes, Senator Chair Roland, Senator Byrne, I agree. That's difficult to make that one-to-one correlation with the poverty data, and because we simply can't access that information in our part of the Department of Education. We don't have access to, for example, those participants in free or reduced lunch data at a student level. To date, it's fairly been more of an aggregate basis trying to arrive at that information. And at the direction of the legislature, it was requested that we use census data. And then again, we felt that the census, the SAP, was probably the best model to use that. But I do hear what you're saying as far as trying to get at that student level data and trying to gather that poverty information.
Is the methodology trying to get at the degree of poverty or just students in poverty?
Chair Roblin, Senator Beyer, it's trying to get at a statistical number. So I don't think that's an either-or question. It's neither degree or the number of students. I think it's trying to say we use all of this data, including, like, again, the federal income tax returns and the U.S. Department of Agriculture Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program data. So I think it's trying to get a count of students, of actually it's children age 5 to 17 living in families in poverty is the official number that comes from the U.S. Census through the SAPI data. So I think it's trying to get closer to that rather than this district has more severe poverty than that district and a relative number. I think it's trying to get closer to the number of children and families age 5 to 17, number of children age 5 to 17 in families living in poverty.
Senator Hass.
Thank you. I've corresponded with Senator Byers on this issue before, and I know you earlier mentioned Beaverton. And there was just this very, very counterintuitive issue with Beaverton in Washington County and poverty. Beaverton School District has more homeless students than any other school district, including Portland, just raw numbers. And, when you're from Roseburg or outside, it just doesn't seem to make sense. But some of our schools, Aloha Huber, for example, has a 90% free and reduced lunch population. You can walk from that school to Nike. You could walk from that school to one of the Intel fab plants. But that's the reality. Why there are so many, why it's concentrated, is a very complicated discussion that would take the rest of the evening. But there are a lot of families in poverty up there in raw numbers in Beaverton and Hillsboro. I would bet you the number of families living in poverty in those two cities are greater than all of the numbers of families in Eastern Oregon in poverty, just a lot of them. And so that's why when you see Beaverton with a higher concentration of and higher factors in the formula, you think, wow, Beaverton unemployment, it's at 3%. But there is that issue too, and it's something that our community has been dealing with for a long time. There is literally a school bus route in Beaverton for homeless kids. And so, I would tell you that the Beaverton School District would much rather not have to have this extra money and not have these families in poverty. Mm-hmm. And probably that is true for all of the school districts, mm-hmm. but it is a really counterintuitive and difficult situation in Washington County.
Okay. Chair Roland, Senator Hass, thank you for the observation and insight. So we saw something similar with Grants Pass, also again along that trying to answer the question, why are we seeing those increases in Grants Pass? And we can only speculate that there's jobs available and families are moving from the smaller communities to Grants Pass to try to get those jobs. And then it's just enough to raise them above the poverty level.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, thank you for the presentation. There are a few things I like having presentations about more than the state school fund. And this one, you added another favorite topic, which is foster care. And what struck me was that your foster care in one district is high and the other is zero. I'm wondering how consistent it is district to district in the reporting of foster children and youth in those. And when do you claim them, given the transience of foster youth and how frequently we're moving them both in and out of foster care and across district boundaries?
Chair Roblin, Senator Gelser, we receive foster care data from the Department of Human Services, and it is updated once a year. So, yes, the migratory, transitory, it's very much were you in foster care in this district at this time period, you would be counted for that district. But if you're not there for the full year, that's the data set we have.
And follow up?
Yep.
So on the recent federal report, and I think the Oregonian unfortunately had the headline, Oregon fails in every possible way, it talked about the intersection of data for foster children and youth with education, and one of the problems that identified was that for the majority of children in foster care, all education information is missing from the DHS database, including the school district, the school, and the grade level of the student. If that is missing, does that mean that they are not able to report to you the actual number of foster children that you're serving in Oregon schools, and therefore following up with the funding that's needed to support them?
Chair Roblin, Senator Gelser, as far as the collection methodology and the data supplied from the Department of Human Services, I'm not intimately familiar with that information, but the trends that we see reported with foster students from DHS appear to be consistent, but I haven't actually performed an audit to really say for sure if that data is correct or not.
And Mr. Chair, just as a Please. Suggestion for a future topic, that was a piece that really stuck out to me in that report, because I've asked other questions like where are our foster youth in terms of being on track for high school graduation. As we've been interviewing foster youth across the state, I've been stunned by the number of kids that don't go to school at all. They just don't go, and they maybe haven't been since middle school. And I think that's both a human service issue but also an education issue, and if we could spend some time looking at that. It's probably an underserved population that we need to figure out how to get at if we want to hit our 40-40-20 goals.
Yeah. So most of the data here is not coming from the schools. It's coming from other sources. Not most, but some of it. So the ADMR, that's coming directly from schools. Special ed, probably directly from schools. The waiver cap, that's known after you've done the other stuff. ELL, is that directly from the schools?
Correct.
That's school data.
Yes,
pregnant and parenting?
Directly from school.
Poverty is now a different kind of thing. It is basically Census Bureau analysis of the population, and they would give you a number that says 27% of the people in this are below the poverty line. You would apply that to the number, the ADMW or ADMR, whichever one you want, and come up with the number of people that formula predicts.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Chair Roman, that is correct.
Okay. So, and they at Census update that annually? Do they update? So once a year you're going to get a new number for the percentage of people, and you're going to apply that to their number of people, and that's going to be whatever it is. So I can see why Beaverton might, you know, they don't have any control over it. They just know that once the federal government has figured out what the poverty rate is, they apply it to the number of kids they have, and they get a number. It may or may not be right. It's just the best guess we can have at getting that poverty number. Foster care comes not from the schools again, even though most schools know which of their kids are foster kids. We have that data, but you don't get that from the schools. You get it from DHS.
Chair Roland, that is correct.
What we're hearing from what Senator Gelser said may or may not have that piece of information on their data stream. Therefore, if their data isn't accurate, your data isn't accurate.
Chair Roland,
what they send you is not accurate. That number that up there would not have any relationship to what the school may think they have for foster kids.
Chair Roblin, I've been working with the State School Fund for approximately 10 years.
Yeah.
And I do get the occasional call from school districts regarding identifying that, you know, we have X amount of foster students in our system. But in all my years' experience, I haven't had any large discrepancies where school districts were.
I can believe that because there's not a large number of kids in the total population. Mm-hmm. The other question that I would have then, is there ever any, what would I say, getting at Senator Gelser's question, is there ever any time when we look at the number of foster care people total in the DHS system compared to the number of foster care kids the schools say they're teaching? Because it would be interesting to check that number out.
That actually would be a very smart way to do the comparison.
Schools have an idea who they are, and so if there's a particular time when you're picking out DHS and a particular time, the schools could answer that question and just say, click the button and say, this is the foster kids we think we have, and this is the foster kids that DHS says they are supporting. It'd be nice to know if those numbers matched.
That would be nice, but there's always going to be a slight disconnect, because there's a certain percent of that population that's transient. They move from foster home to foster home, but it might cost more to try to track that than money.
But it seems like the way you could track it.
If you pick a day, a day when you are going to get DHS's number, and at that same day we ask the schools to put the number in.
How many?
Those should get close.
Mr. Chair, a gross number. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The other way that you could do it is there's a date on which it's taken, and you could look at the number of waits claimed, and you could look on that date for the number of kids between the ages of 5 and 18 that are in care on that day. And since we have a compulsory education law, one would assume they should be at school. Do the number of kids in care match the number of waits that are claimed?
And I'm not sure you can solve all the problems in the world, but I will tell you that a lot of us try to have you figure out data-wise how you can inform us more. And we do appreciate the work that's been done. And I know that it's not a simple answer or a simple question, but whenever you go out and get estimates of any group, and especially in these small districts, and I know that's a difficult one for you with regard to it, even the sampling of small districts, as we all know, is never as accurate as when you have a nice big number to work with. But when that N is small, it's really hard to predict. It's always going to be going up and down. And I will tell you that some of the small districts like this one, I don't envy them losing 47 weights when you have is this the big school? No, it's the big school district. It's the other one. They were losing the same number, though, and I was thinking, that would be a rude awakening that day when you look and you say, okay, what am I doing with those teachers? Where am I going to get it? Because the only way in schools, the only thing you have is teachers. I mean, it all comes down to personnel. And if you don't have the money, you got to get rid of the personnel. And that is frightening to watch happen in short periods of time. I don't know about this averaging it. Though in the past, I guess we smoothed it out over 10-year periods because we only use data from the census, right? So there was a 10-year balancing as opposed to a 5. So we went through 2 recessions before we got the new data the last time. Mm-hmm. And it was up at the beginning and up at the end. So nobody knew what happened in the middle. Okay. Thank you.
Good discussion. I guess I'm still a little unclear on the smoothing question. You know, what are you going to do this year with the numbers that you've released? Are you going to hold to those?
Chair Roland, Senator Beyer, yes. We've just recently made the update to the 15-16. The SAPE data that we're going to be using, that will hold consistent. We will marry that with the ADM data, and so there'll be a slight adjustment based on the ADM, but the districts will know what that number is moving forward. So there should be some predictability there, but the SAPE number is not going to move.
Gonna hear some screaming from some districts who have just got with their parents and said, "Great, now we're gonna lay off teachers." After we've just told them that we've increased funding, and said, "Wait a minute, you told me we increased funding, and now I'm gonna lay off 100 teachers?"
They should never overspend. I just don't understand. No.
one additional point that I do want to make along that line, Senator Roland, Beyer, that money doesn't simply just—it doesn't disappear. Because the waiting for the poverty, that obligation is reduced, so actually more money is available for the general education, for the base weight, and so it adds back there, and it gets redistributed. So granted, it's not a one-to-one match, but some of that money is redistributed to the districts in a different venue.
Okay. Thank you for the insights, and it is interesting how you have
set more money aside.
Well, it's like that one that we heard before. It would be nice to have an emergency fund to help out some of these things some other way, but thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to close the informational meeting, and I guess two things. One, if you haven't already made sure that Richard knows that we're going to McLaren, we have an opportunity to go. Where are we leaving and when are we doing it?
We're leaving, thank you, Mr. Members of the Committee. The Committee's leaving from about 8:15 in the morning, Thursday morning.
We're at?
Out front of this building, or you can be at McLaren shortly before 9 a.m.
And having done that before, field trip, I think it is always, and before our mayor leaves, anyway, I was going to introduce our new mayor of Salem after the election.
It's easier to make those decisions.
Oh, no, that is not him.
And it's your money, your business.
So with that, is there any other information that needs to come before the committee from any member? Seeing none, we are adjourned. Any member? Seeing none, we are adjourned. The committee from